Hiya, Tim here with a message before the podcast. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from Elvis Costello's King of America. All tracks are written by Elvis Costello, except Lovable, which was also written by Kate O'Riordan, and Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which was written by Benny Benjamin, Sol Marcus, Gloria Caldwell, and Eisenhower Blues by J.B. Lenoir. King of America was released on 21st February 1986 on F-Beat and Columbia. Now enjoy the podcast.
Where real music matters.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
Hiya, I'm Tim Burgess and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. If it's your first time listening, this is a show where I sit down with an artist, going through a classic album and hearing the stories behind it. I've had loads of interesting conversations so far with guests from Sparks and Texas to The Kinks and U2. To catch up on any of these episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts to discover a whole archive of past listening parties. Just like Tim's Twitter Listening Party, a huge part of this is your involvement. So please get involved on social media throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party and check out @Tim_Burgess and @AbsoluteRadio on X for more listening party content. This episode, I'm joined by Elvis Costello to talk about his 1986 album, King of America, which has been re-released as King of America and Other Realms, a new six-disc box set, including the remaster of this classic album, a previously unreleased live concert, demos, outtakes, live recordings, so much there to discover. Elvis Costello has rightly been lauded as one of the greatest songwriters of his generation. His music embraces jazz, country, classical, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, Tin Pan Alley, with Dylan-esque lyricism which is underpinned by punk ethics and traditions. His genre-spanning career has seen him cross paths with everyone from Alan Toussaint to The Roots, Paul McCartney to Burt Bacharach, and his genius has been rewarded with a BAFTA, multiple Grammys, and Ivor Novello Awards. So I think we're on.
We're on.
Which is very exciting. And I'm very excited to talk to you. I really wanted to kind of start by saying that, you know, I wanted to thank you for appearances on Top of the Pops when I was a kid.
Oh, my God.
And I wanted to thank you for Oliver's Army and, you know, watching The Detectives, Accidents Will Happen, Don't Want to Go to Chelsea. I also wanted to thank you for Shipbuilding. I wanted to thank you for The Other Side of Summer. That's probably one of my favorite records of yours.
I like that record.
It's so good. And and thanks for doing this.
Thank you. It's funny, when I was in the country right on my birthday, which was a big one this year, I was telling the audience at the shows afterwards, I said I was listening, I watch radio, BBC4, a lot, you know, because it's late at night and they're showing old quiz shows from the 70s that I remember when I was a teenager, and I was like, they come on, the continuity announcer comes on and goes, "And now, in a tribute to one of Britain's least remembered songwriters, here is the Top of the Pops." And they showed the very first one we were ever on, the very first Top of the Pops we were on, and we'd flown down from Glasgow.
Right.
We'd actually had to charter a plane, you know, which
were you
was
on
a
tour,
big deal.
Or to be on tour, is that?
Well, it wasn't so much that we were on tour, first time up in Scotland, banned out of playing in Glasgow, because everything on the Stiff label was regarded as probably it was going to be that dastardly punk rock.
Yeah.
And the Damned had been up there with the Pistols, and they weren't having that kind of music anymore, the City Fathers. It was so strange. It was like you read about in the 50s, you know, we had to play in a hotel in Paisley, get up the next morning and honestly go to the little airfield, and all the money that the record company Stiff could afford was for this little prop plane. You know, it wasn't anything, it wasn't a private jet by any means.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like Biggles came out of a hut to fly us down to. It was terrifying. And then we were thrust into the world of show business, and the rest is misery. You know? It's funny to see it, though, because, you know, I was so proud of my Musicians Union card that I wore it in my top pocket.
Oh, yeah.
They still had an orchestra then on the Top of the Pops, and I wanted to prove to the old guys, some of whom were friends of my dad's, that, you know, I was a real musician. I wasn't some sort of interloper. Yeah.
And how old were you on your first appearance?
Probably, it was, I might just have been 23, I think, 22 or 23. Yeah. And actually, maybe on the first time. Yeah, first time, yeah. 21 when I wrote the record, 20, you know, between 21 and 22 when I wrote the record and recorded it, because it wasn't all recorded at once.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then you get into it a little bit and you sort of get into the routine, as I'm sure you're very familiar with, where you are, you know, it's time to make a record and you have to hope that you've got the inspiration when it's time, when you've got a contract. It's sort of great in one respect, as there's some continuity and security to it.
Yeah.
The certainty of a job. But after a while, you can either become entitled to it, or you can, it may, you know, the date in the calendar may not be where you're feeling that you're sharpest about what you want to do next, you know. So I think that's why records go up and down in quality. It's not necessarily that people have lost their minds. It's just, you know, sometimes they've lost their minds.
You were always on the telly.
It felt like for a while as if it was.
It's so great.
Thank goodness we got away from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, well, thank goodness I was there to see that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, somebody, I mean, that's the thing. When people said, oh, you changed the number on, when the first time we were on American television, we switched the number out live on the air. I said, I was only doing what I saw Jimi Hendrix do when I was a teenager. And I wasn't even a teenager. I was probably not, I don't know what year that was. It was when Hendrix was on the Lulu show and he switched. It was 1968. So, yeah, I was a teenager. Yeah. That's all of it, isn't it? I think it's what you, the cues you get, the special thing that you're on. You know, I mean, I remember all sorts of funny things of being on the television early on. I remember being, you know, you're being on with people like Hank Marvin was on one time, and I was in a chair next to him, and he wears the same kind of glasses as I do.
Yes.
And the makeup, you know, ladies were trying to make us both look presentable. I have to say, I had a lot less work to do on Hank than on me. But, you know, bizarre kind of things would happen like that, or you'd be on. We did one show in Birmingham where there was actually a revolving stage, and we played our number and revolved out of sight, and the Buzzcocks came in playing their number.
Was that the show Revolver?
Revolver,
with Peter Cook.
Peter Cook as host, which was a disastrous idea of Mickey Mouse. The audience really hated Peter Cook, and he didn't want to be there, and it was like, seemed like a good idea in theory, but it was a complete...
It's kind of punk.
It was, so, yeah, because he just gave back the insults to them because he was quick, you know. But but I spoke to him briefly, and I think he didn't really know me from a hole in the ground, but I think he might have had a couple of drinks, you know, just to sort of like take the edge off the indignity. Yeah.
Let's kick off this listening party with the first track from King of America. It's Brilliant Mistake. That was Brilliant Mistake by Elvis Costello, the first song from his 1986 album, King of America. So we're going to go through it track by track, if that's okay with you. And, you know, we can get some interesting quips and bursts of insight.
Ha!
So it opens with Brilliant Mistake, and also opens with the lyric that gives the album its name.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he was the King of America, where they pour Coca-Cola just like vintage wine. Then goes on later to say that he was the King of America, but it was the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. Is it a song about disillusionment, how the mighty fall, or...?
I think it was trying to do a lot of things at once, actually.
Okay.
I felt like it carried... I knew that it was kind of the theme song of the record before I recorded it. You know, I did know that much.
Well...
Curiously enough, as we put this box together, separately to the version that's heard on King of America, the original album, there's a second CD inside that box which contains the demos that I made, some of which I hadn't heard for 40 years.
Oh, my God.
Because I put them away in a cupboard and we'd just forgotten about them. And I had when we were putting this together, I said... I don't think we've got all the demos here. We've got only the ones recorded in Hollywood. What happened to the ones that I did in London? And everybody went, what ones you did in London? I said, I did a session. I remember I did it. I couldn't even remember the name of the studio. I had no notebooks of these drafts of these songs. And when we got the tape, and, you know, thankfully it was in good enough condition to, wasn't a lot to mix, it's just a guitar and a voice. Brilliant mistake. Gets to the second verse, and it becomes a completely different song.
Oh.
I mean, it's about something different. There's no stuff about the ABC News, that's not in it.
Right.
And I wouldn't say it's a better lyric, but it might be a little bit more true to life, so to speak. It's a much more of an account of what I think might have been going on around that time.
Okay.
And as you sometimes come to recognize, if you write enough songs, writing things out in a literal way isn't always the most communicative thing. It can be satisfying to do it, it can be, but it can also be indulgent.
Yeah.
So at some point I decided to change the song to the one you hear on the and it therefore it moves around from topic to topic. It moves from the personal to the more universal.
Yeah.
Whereas the other song stayed completely personal all the way. Now, people did have to hear that demo, said, well, I think you should have recorded that. Well, I didn't, because that isn't what I wanted to do. But that's part of the process of writing, and it's unusual to find the sketches for something and find them to be so different to the finished thing.
Yeah.
It's, for me, very, very unusual for me not to remember them. Because I remember everything.
Yep.
You know, I can remember gigs I did 40 years ago, what songs I sang, Color of the Wallpaper. You know, it's almost a curse. This, for some reason, maybe I shut it away and didn't want to confront what the songs were about. But like I say, I still hold to the fact that the song that you hear on that record is a brighter, more conflicted song rather than a... The demo is a much more desperate sounding thing. It's much more defeated. And I don't think that's the way you'd want to open a record.
No,
you'd want to open it with...
Okay, I'd love to hear it in mind, but, you know.
Yeah, well, you can.
Yeah,
you can. You can hear it in a bus. And, it, you know, it's not as pretty a performance as this is, because you've got all the other decorative elements. You've got Jerry Sheff and Mickey Curry in the rhythm section, and you've got T-Bone Walk, who was actually a bass player, but was also a terrific accordionist, and he was playing, you know, both guitar and... He overdubbed guitar, and we didn't do a lot of overdubs. You know, most of this record was played live in the studio or, you know, gathered around me. But once in a while, there would just be one other part added, a piano part here or whatever it was. You know, I played mandolin. It's my only credit as a mandolinist. You know, brutal though that playing is, you know, on little passes. You know.
Wonderful.
But I think you're right. And the tune is a kind of folk melody, which is found in hymns.
Yes.
It's found in Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring.
He
used
nice.
The same melody, this da da do da da do da da do da, that kind of movement.
Yeah.
It's in pop songs. It's not a melody that I can really lay claim to. It's a folk melody, really. A lot of pop songs have origins of that. And that seemed like the right thing when you're talking about both an ideal and a location.
That's amazing, man.
And I was there doing it. Actually, there I was doing it. I didn't imagine the record would be recorded quite as it was. I did originally conceive this album as being one side acoustic and the second side electric.
Were it?
And Brilliant Mistake might have actually been the last track on the record.
Wow.
With a full electric accompaniment. That's in the total abstract. That's what I heard.
Yeah.
Once I abandoned that first draft, the next thought was it was going to be electric, and therefore the Attractions would have played it.
Yeah.
But they never did, because we cut this version, and that was the end of that. And that's kind of what happened with a lot of the recordings on this, is that the process of recording led me to a different way to express the songs that seemed at that moment to be the right one. And although I've played many of these songs with members of the then Attractions, now the Impostors, the recorded versions were the ones that were on the album.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's the right one.
Yeah, and it's the moment, isn't it, as well? You know, you're capturing the time.
Yeah, it's the moment where you recognise, oh, that's the way it goes.
Yeah,
you know,
that's it.
That one a little bit more than some of the other songs, which were more obviously lent themselves to the style of players that we had in the studio, I think.
Got you. Okay. Let's hear the second track from King of America. This is Lovable. Yes, I just can't get you. That last track was called Lovable, and I've just, my only note here is You're So Lovable. I mean, it's such a gorgeous song.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of a bit, it's a bit more, it's upbeat, isn't it? It's a great second track, you know, kind of, you got the opening one, A Brilliant Mistake, and then Lovable is up-tempo.
It's kind of like an Everly Brothers Buddy Holly kind of trick with that, you know, that quick little figure on the guitar. And unusual, it was kind of like, I hadn't played sort of swinging rhythms like that since my first record.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, my first record was accompanied by American musicians as well. And the American, you know, they have easy access to that swinging sort of feel, you know. And also maybe because it don't always play too fast. English bands tend to be really like urgent, you know, and all the best ones. And I've said this many times, but I do think there's some truth to it. I said, like, if you think about it, all the great English rock bands, rock and roll bands, very few of them know how to close a phrase off. They just know how to start, and their first idea, like the Who, you know, can't explain, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, there is a groove to a lot of these records, and people would cite many examples of it. The Beatles had some amazing feels, particularly towards the end of their career. But compare that to Booker T and the MGs.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Or the Funk Brothers, where everything is about how we phrase together and the discipline. Yeah. Or even like Muddy Waters bands, you know, if you listen to what's actually going on, it's why bands copying them sound so terrible and why those records sound so great, is because they're not all playing the same thing. They're not all going dunk, 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 dunk. There's all different angular things going on. It's arranged. It might be harmonically very, very, just using three chords or one chord sometimes. But nobody steps on anybody else, and that's the difference, largely speaking, I think, between an English and American approach to the same musical language. Of course, the two countries have like influenced each other in that approach. There's bands in America that copied that gung-ho kind of English approach, you know, English British, I suppose, because you get some Scottish groups as well, you know. But there's something to this. It's not just a mad theory that, you know. What I recognize right away was I'm in the studio basically with Elvis Presley's band. You know, I've got three of Elvis Presley's band. Most of all, I've got James Burton on electric guitar.
Love him.
I'm not going anywhere near an electric guitar while he's in the room. That's definitely not going to happen. You know? I just play rhythm, and I, you know, there was so much space for a song.
Yeah.
You know, Lovable, I think, is Keltner, is Jim Keltner.
I is
think
it?
That
yeah.
was cut
wow.
a little bit
wow.
later. Yeah,
I've actually had the pleasure of playing with Jim Keltner, which is wonderful.
He's an incredible musician.
Oh yeah,
and
James Burton. I know obviously he's Elvis guitarist, but Gram Parsons, I'm a huge Gram Parsons fan.
Truthfully, I have to give credit to T-Bone Burnett. He was the one that wrote down the names of the players next to the songs, and I thought he was kidding. You know, I thought, can you just get James Burton on your record? But is there a sort of some exam you have to pass before you can have that happen? I didn't realize you just called them up and invited them and booked them for the session. To me, they were just names on record sleeves, you know. And Keltner was on so many records, many of which I really loved, that I thought he can't possibly be as open as he turns out to be, as inventive as he turns out to be. He must be more, I don't know, I just had this crazy delusion that he'd be more settled in his way, and he approaches everything as if it's brand new. And so, I mean, when we got in, there was some of my own prejudices I had to get over, and not prejudices, you know, bias. I just felt like, oh, he, and then I go, oh my God, this is incredible. With Ronnie Tutt, you know, who played in the TCB band, as we called them, because it was three members of the Elvis band. That was just such a machine between him and Jerry Sheff that, you know, James was totally free to play the decorative parts. And it's true to say I was the same. I was most thrilled that I had the guy that had played on the Return of the Grievous Angel and was in the hot band with Emmy, you know. And that was my thrill of James coming in. I didn't want to make a big deal, and I wondered whether any of those guys would have any misgiving about working with me because of my stupid stage name, you know. And they, you know, I think they realized right away I wasn't an Elvis impersonator, you know. I mean, it was like I was truthfully not even that much of an Elvis Presley fan. That's the weird thing. I mean, I love the Sun records and I love the Memphis records, and it, you know,
of course,
but nothing else really. Not compared with Little Richard, you know, or Jerry Lee. So of that era, I learned a lot of that music after the fact. And the fact that the Beatles championed Little Richard made Little Richard the rock and roll guy to pay attention to. I knew the Beatles spoke about Elvis, but I didn't hear the evidence of them sounding like him. Whereas Paul McCartney actually sang Long Tall Sally, you know.
Yeah, they did.
Given any chance, he would sing Lucille, you know. When I worked with him much later, you know, when I was grown up and I got to write with Paul, I went to a rehearsal one night when he was hiring musicians for his touring band, and ended up playing piano because there was no pianist. He'd already picked the pianist, so there was no pianist. So I ended up playing best I could, a little bit rhythm piano. And it was only when he said, "Okay, we're going to play Lucille," I go, "Well, no, I'm sitting this one out. I can't play that part," you know. So it's. But that was what he wanted to play. Was like he wanted to test the musician's ability to play songs that he'd loved since he had been a teenager. Didn't matter whether I assumed that they were at the audition, they could play the songs he'd written. But he wanted to know whether they could feel the other songs. All right, then that's kind of what the experience I had. I knew I had all this shared language with these musicians. I knew that Jim Keltner was the drummer on Boomer's Story, just that one song.
Yeah.
If he was just the drummer on Boomer's Story, that would be enough for me, you know.
Right.
Because that, you know, it's the same as like, you know, Graham going, "Pick it for me, James." And then he does, and he plays that little, tells a story. Or James's solo on "Till I Got in Control Again," you know, on Elite Hotel, you know. I mean, these were things that I thought, if I can get anything that complements the melody I've written that's anywhere, and he does it several times on the record, you know. He plays a solo short and concise and beautifully constructed straight out of thin air, and also it's pretty exciting when he on the big light when he did dun, 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 he's doing the CC Rider kind of,
it's very,
you know,
exciting.
Elvis in Vegas kind of guitar playing, you know. And you kind of go, oh my god, you know. I said, get my karate kit out, you know.
Moving on to track 3 on the album, it's Our Little Angel. Elvis Costello with Our Little Angel. I wanted to talk about my favourite on the album. There's a couple of favourites, but one of my favourites, Our Little Angel.
Yeah.
Pulls at the heartstrings, or certainly pulls at my heartstring.
Yeah.
Mentions mistakes again.
Yeah.
I know, it's in the lyric, or misfortune.
I think it is. I mean, it's a portrait, it's a snapshot of a, you know, sort of girl who is the queen of a particular scene, you know. And I guess I probably had... I usually don't write, true to life. I try to think of things that have happened or things I've observed and put them in a song so other people can see themselves. If they're too many inside references to something that really happened, nobody knows what the hell are you talking about. It's some conversation you had, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Yeah. And if the song's going to endure, it's got to be in language that people can understand.
I mean, I'm going to say that I do the same thing.
Oh, we all do it.
But it's the degree to which you settle on.
Some people settle for the literal thing. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but for me, it just being exactly what happened doesn't make it a better song.
Agreed.
It only makes it a better song if you're somehow magically able to make that communicate to everybody. And a lot of the really great so-called confessional records have an element of craft within the writing, which you ignore at your peril if you're trying to write like those people. The numerous people that have tried to go to Where Blue Lives, you know, by Joni, or where Blood on the Tracks, which is a very good example of this thing where
it can't be cuffed.
Some of the time seems to be completely revealing. Then there's an obvious line of invention within the lyric. I met a man from Italy. I mean, these things could be transpositions of real events, but they disguise the nakedness of pain or anger in songs, not to evade it, but to make it so that it's. I honestly believe there's an ingenuity to that writing.
Yeah.
And I've tried to learn little by little not to just indulge the instinct to literally write out the account, but to think about how it feels to experience something. You can't slow life down to the pace of heartbreak. You can't slow the listener's life down to the pace of, you know, the great country songs, they distill experiences.
Yeah.
You know, I've been living a new life, you know, or whatever the opening line is. By the door, you know, you'll see the nursery. She left me without mercy. That's the Grand Tour by George Jones. I mean, two lines, and it completely distills the thing of somebody being abandoned, you know, somebody leaving a family home. I don't suppose that real life, true to life, in real time account of that scanned. You know, it probably involved throwing things and screaming and crying and recrimination and stuff that doesn't fit in a verse. And it's possible to represent those things in music, of course it is. But it doesn't necessarily work like that when you're trying to write this type of music to it. This was the distilled version of those experiences, like Our Little Angel. And I'm glad you like that.
Oh,
that
it's amazing.
One has a lovely James. That has a beautiful James interlude in it.
This perfectly scans. Now the cabaret, I've frozen, and the laughter comes in cans. And the Lonely Hearts Club clientele don't know what to do with their hands. I mean, it's gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, I used to play a Lonely Hearts Club in Liverpool with my partner. We used to play one. And I know it sounds like a joke. We played a Lonely Hearts Club in Liverpool, but it really was. It was held in an old former RAF serviceman's club. And they would hire it for this mixer club. It was basically like I suppose it was a forerunner of Tinder, you know.
Yeah.
It was like where people would go to meet. But people were still quite inhibited. And one side of the room would be young women and the other side men. But they wouldn't speak at first. They'd be too shy. Then we'd play to almost complete indifference while they were all furtively looking at each other. And then, of course, once they had a couple of drinks and they started talking, then they ignored us anyway. So we never had any respect. But that's like 1972.
Wow. Yeah. Up next is Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood on Absolute Radio. Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which was the single. Is that your favourite Nina Simone song?
To be really honest, I learnt it from The Animals because of my age. I heard it first by The Animals.
Right.
I love Nina Simone's version. I love her records. But I can't pretend that I learnt it firsthand from her. Obviously, I heard Eric Burdon first.
That's a good version.
I, 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 I did toy with the idea of completely remixing it,
right,
this record,
okay,
at one point. I didn't know whether anybody would be interested to hear a parallel remix. Obviously, you wouldn't replace the original mix. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it was to take this track off the record, because I don't think it belongs on the record. It was added,
okay,
at the insistence of the record company because they hated the songs than the rest of the record. They didn't understand why I was writing these, to them, miserable country songs, and didn't think that the, you know, people who had been excited about Every Day I Write the Book, and, you know, which was a bright pop,
yeah,
sort of sound,
mm-hmm,
and thing, would play this, and they were probably right, because they didn't play it, but this song on its own didn't change that. It was just an attempt to make something, and I thought, well, that's a big compliment, isn't it? You've written Indoor Fireworks, American Without Tears, Brilliant Mistake, Poison Rose,
Little Angel, phenomenal.
But you've written those songs and you hand them in to the record company and they say, well, what we really need is a good song. And can it be something people already know? And that's basically where we, you,
yeah,
know, we parted the ways,
yeah,
you know, because I wasn't going back. I was, even then I knew I wasn't going there,
yeah,
anymore.
Yeah.
And the few opportunities I've had to smuggle an idea that mattered to me onto the radio in the guise of pop music, I'd already done it, obviously. Oliver's Army is a very good example, mm-hmm, of a bright pop tune that's singing about something serious. Other Side of Summer's another example, and Veronica's another example. So it's not like I abandoned. I'm not a snob about pop music, but it wasn't going to be the whole of the reason why this record existed. So I think we made a pretty interesting record out of Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood.
Yeah, no, it sounds fantastic.
Notwithstanding me having completely lost my voice when we did it, and then, so the voice, I thought the irony of it was this was recorded at the insistence of Columbia Records, and then when they got the record, nobody could recognize me on the record because it didn't sound like
me. Right.
I was so hoarse when I sang it. I don't know, it could have been Harvey Fierstein, isn't he? That guy, it could have been him singing it, you know?
The next song is Glitter Gulch. Glitter Gulch, followed by Indoor Fireworks.
Yeah, well,
there's no real question. It's just I'm just making an observation.
No, it's just a statement.
It's just
really
a statement.
You're just making a statement.
I really like Glitter Gulch, but I mean, you know, I'm also excited to get to Indoor Fireworks.
No, come on,
as well.
No, but I mean, let's be straightforward here. That's the other one that I probably would have. There's three tracks I might have taken off a remixed version of this record,
uh-huh,
and obviously this is just theorizing.
Yeah,
anybody could do this because you just make a playlist of your favorite songs on this record. Glitter Gulch was something I came up with because I wanted to hear more James Burton, really.
Fine.
I just wanted to hear him play.
Yeah.
I wrote it in 5 minutes. It's like a nothing song. I mean, you've got to say that I'd go home from the studio and turn on the television, probably had a few cocktails and, you know, like game shows and stuff like that, the lurid nature of it. You're in Hollywood, they're surrounded by the supposed glamour and the actual sleaze of Hollywood, you know, and that's not, you don't have to go looking for it. It's in all of the weird juxtaposition. The song's not hard to write.
No.
It was like, you know, I'm not dismissing it. It's just a little rockabilly tune, but it was just like, once we'd done The Big Light, I just wanted him to do it again. You know, can get one that's a bit faster again and play even wilder, you know.
It reminded me of Gower Gulch in Hollywood. I used to live in Hollywood.
Well, we were recording right next to it. I don't doubt that Gower Gulch was... I thought, I can't sing Gower Gulch. I thought,
no,
I have to sing Glitter Gulch. I'm sure that's where I got the title from. Almost certainly where it is.
Wow. God, I mean, I was just throwing that out there then. I had no idea.
I probably wrote it on the way back from the off license. You know, it's one of those. I mean, sometimes those Possession on Get Happy is written on the way back to the studio. And that's a good track.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes writing songs because of the way you feel isn't a bad thing. Not everything has to be your last will and testament. So there's a, I think in the end, I mean, to say that I obviously abandoned the idea to remix the record because I knew people would be bewildered. It wasn't like it was well known enough. Most people have never heard of this record. It's very odd to put out of such a big box, let alone the original album, but a six CD thing that tells a story, which to a lot of people, I'm sure, is a very obscure idea, even why it carries on from King of America through these other elements. But if you read the essay that I wrote, it does explain what I'm feeling.
Okay.
If you care, it's 40 years of my life. It's just a diary of these particular musical adventures. But the starting point, and often the returning point, is the friendship and the partnership as songwriters, as record makers with T-Bone.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
it goes from King of America to Spike.
Yeah.
To, and then there's, you know, a long gap where we're not in the studio making whole albums, but in which I'm contributing to some of the things that he's working on, which is a lot of the stuff I did My Mood Swings for The Big Lebowski. I did, we wrote The Scarlet Tide for Cold Mountain, I recorded other music for that, which, you know, they recorded a lot of music that wasn't used.
It is.
So, I mean, I was recording American folk songs in my style and then even right up to fairly recently, after we had done Secret Prophetic Sugarcane and National Ransom around 2008-2010, I'm involved in the concert at Town Hall for Inside Llewyn Davis. I mean, I got to write a new version of Which Side Are You On and sing it with John Baez.
Right.
I mean, this would have never happened without T-Bone, you know. Right. We did the Speaking Clock review, which was an incredible, like, pageant of a show. It only did three performances, but it was Dr. Ralph Stanley, Karen Elson, Jeff Bridges, the Punch Brothers, Jim James.
Wow.
I mean, all on, and with Elton and Leon closing because they're just on their record, The Union. I mean, obviously, having T-Bone be your older, smarter, taller brother really gets you into some scrapes, you know. I mean, a lot to do with this record is the introductions that he made to people. Indoor Fireworks is where I think we had settled into the confidence to now, it wasn't about, okay, we've got this A-team, which is the TCB band, and then we've got the other squad, which is this one over here, which are equally great.
So
and now we've got, like, Jerry Sheff and Jim Keltner as a rhythm section, which is, it's unlovable, and I think it's on this record. James Burton playing, on Indoor Fireworks is beautiful. And I think Mitchell Froom was in there as well, who had joined on organ.
Yeah.
We were starting to kind of, like, I was starting to kind of be more, less frenetic now and really dig in. And I knew this was a good song. I had to get it right, you know. I knew this was the one, really. It's turned out to be, I mean, the only song from King of America that's ever been covered is Roseanne Cash's version of Our Little Angel.
I
don't know why, country singers have not, like, embraced Indoor Fireworks. I suspect it's because it refers to a martini in the second verse. And martinis are just not the thing, are they, in country music? You know, can't see... That's going to be very relatable, isn't it, if you mention a martini. That sounds like a damn Yankee drink to me. You know? Like, no. Anyway, one way or another, I mean, I love
everybody loves the happy ending, but we don't even try.
Well, there's some allusions to Charlie Rich in there as well.
Okay.
You know, Behind Closed Doors is sort of half quoted, and that's a thing that happens a few times in the songs. They locate the drama of the song with a reference to a song that you either knew or loved or happened to be playing, you know.
Yeah.
Happens again in two other songs on this record. And it's a device that I had used from way back, you know, and other people do as well, you know.
Oh, the sparks would fly, thought our love was fireproof. Sometimes we'd fight in public, darling, with very little cause. But different kinds of sparks would fly when we got on our own behind closed doors. Indoor fireworks can still burn your fingers. Indoor fireworks.
Did you find it helpful growing up in Liverpool?
Well, I didn't actually grow up in Liverpool. That's sort of like the way the legend has gone now. Is it like I'm claimed when I'm doing well. I'm just a bloody southerner when I'm doing badly, you know.
You do sound like you have a bit of a Liverpool accent.
I don't know. It just comes out sometimes. I don't know why. It's like I did obviously spend all my childhood holidays actually in Birkenhead, my dad's hometown.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Yeah, I would go and stay with my grandmother.
I spent a lot of mine in Rill. Do you remember Rill?
Rill? What you mean? Like that's the French Riviera if you're from Merseyside. You know,
That was
That was a bit of a trip away, you know. That was a day trip to go to Rill.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yes.
Yeah. I remember going there a couple of times. Yeah, Rill and you know, obviously if you went north to Southport, if you were really living, you went to Blackpool. But I don't ever recall going there until my dad was playing up there and I went to help him out, you know. So, but all of that part of the world was... I was christened there, so I mean...
Right.
Yeah, I was actually christened in Birkenhead. I think that makes you a Baconian in some kind of Catholic way.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. The next song is Little Palaces.
Like a picture of Prince William in the arms of John the Pope. There's a world of good intentions and pity in their eyes. The sedated homes of England, there's the vandalized. So you knock the kids about a bit because they've got your name. And you knock the kids about a bit until they feel the same. And they feel like knocking down the little palaces.
Elvis Costello's Little Palaces from the King of America album. There's a song, Little Palaces, that I don't know why. I don't really want to reference other people's work, but Watertown by Frank Sinatra. I got a similar sort of feeling.
Wow, that's a very asset. Now I would have never guessed that would be the reference point. Very, I'm impressed as old get out there.
I mean, it's just like one of the greatest.
I would take that. I would take that. I mean, Watertown is, it's almost a great record.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea.
Yeah.
I was gonna write a column for a publisher, and I was gonna do a series of reviews of imaginary records.
Yeah,
and my first one was Frank Sinatra Takes a Subway to the Country, which is Frank Sinatra sings David Ackles, which is actually the record he should have made when he made Watertown. I mean, the quality of songs that David Ackles' catalogue would have given Frank Sinatra would have been a masterpiece if anybody had had the intelligence to put those songs in front of him and persuade him the way Watertown was created, because he was very good at identifying with things in songs. He did it through his entire career. It wasn't all one-liners and, you know... He could really paint a picture.
Yeah.
And he could do it right up to the end of his life as well.
Right, wow.
I saw him, not the very end, but I saw him in 84 when he was not in terrific voice, but his storytelling, not talking story, but the sung storytelling was still beyond nobody. Nobody could go near him. You know, so, yeah, I mean, I think Watertown is, I'll accept that because it's a portrait of a town. Palaces is... little bit of my grandfather's rage in that, I think. Sort of a difficult man. My My mother's father, that is. He was my mother's father. My mother's father was a guy who carried a few things around. I didn't know him so very well, but it was like assembled from, you know, are you from the city?
Born in Salford.
You're born in Salford, so you know very much what I'm talking about then.
Of course.
My mother's family home, my grandfather's home is in Liverpool 8, so that's, you know, that's as inlivable as you can get, you know. And so that was the, like, that's where they started, and that's where I think, well, that's where we're from, and don't romanticize it, but equally don't dismiss it as though this is a bit of both, this song, I think.
The moments of anger in your voice in this song. Closing side one of the album is I'll Wear It Proudly.
I always thought this was kind of like the R&B song on the record in a way, you know, like it's as much to do with that. I wanted to really hear Percy Sledge sing it.
Oh, wow.
But I couldn't sing like him, so I had to sing it like me. And it's funny, on the live record that we put in the box, which is from the Albert Hall in 87, the next song in the set is It Tears Me Up. So I must have had that in my mind. Yeah. Like, that if you think about it, it's a little bit more of a, got a little bit more of a pocket than the country songs from this. It's Keltner. And then Mitchell Froom, I gave him this organ part for the end, which he then kind of took and put in Crowded House's Don't Dream It's Over and made millions of dollars for. It's the same bloody tune, more or less. Yeah. You know, it's my tune, but it's okay.
You're going to buy you a drink.
It's all just a shared language of music, as they say.
Well, yeah, it's. I mean,
no, Mitch played. I did. I dictated. I said, play this da da do do da da do do da. It's very similar to the theme of Don't Dream It's Over, which he then produced about 6 months later. You know.
Well,
but it's all right. I love those Finns.
Oh yeah,
all of them.
Wear that crown, and you cannot die laughing, because I'll wear it proudly. I'll wear it proudly through the dives and the dancehalls. Do you wear it proudly through the snakefish and catcalls? Like a 15-year-old kid wears a vampire kiss.
You're listening to Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. I'm celebrating the reissue of Elvis Costello's 1986 album King of America by playing it alongside Elvis himself. Moving on to side two of King of America, American Without Tears is the next track. Can you describe what's being conveyed here? This is not, that doesn't give any context to the people listening to the show, but our favourite line was, though he wasn't tall or handsome, she left when I told her, I'm the sheriff of Nottingham. This is Little John.
Yeah, that's kind of a rude line, but it's good, isn't it? Yeah, it's like,
I mean, I guess I like rude.
Yeah, it's about. I did actually meet these two women.
Yeah.
In an afternoon cocktail bar, you know, a place where they were having pre-show cocktails.
Yeah.
Wasn't actually in New Orleans. It was in Las Vegas, but Las Vegas didn't scan, so I put the song in New Orleans.
Yeah.
They told me the story of their life. I don't know why. Ambos just must have looked like have the face of a priest. You know, people tend to confess. And they were telling me all about. And they had been GI brides. They were, you know, this is in the 80s, so they weren't that old. You know, they were probably my age now. If they were like, if I'm thinking about it, you know, 40s to the 80s. It could have been if they were 18 when they came to America. There were two English girls, and they told me and some of the things in the song are really what they told me.
Wow.
And not the Little John thing, I added that.
It's a nice twist.
Yeah, but it was sort of like, because it was very, they didn't know when they were going to see those guys again or when they would see them again. All sorts of naughty things happened. It's not, young people didn't invent sex. People have been having it for decades and millennia, you know. And then it's just, you don't want to think of it being your grandmother or your mother or your auntie. But, I mean, of course they had these adventures. And, and these women were not shy about telling me about it. They seemed kind of thrilled. And the fact that it had worked out to some degree for them as well, and they'd come to America and made another life, was all part of it.
Yeah.
And I was...
Yeah.
And I kind of connected that only in the last verse with where I was. I felt like I had gone to America and never come back in some ways. And my grandfather did precede me to New York in the 20s as a musician. He was a ship's musician.
Wow.
So when I refer to him in the last verse, I'm, you know, then it becomes like... It goes from being a narrative song about two people you've met to being more like, this is where I reverse the what I said about the personal, you know, and the literal. The last the verse says, and now I'm in America and running from you like my grandfather before me walked the streets of New York. And I think of all the women I pretend mean more than you. And I open my mouth and I can't seem to talk. That's... Honestly, the way I felt about certain, you know, the abdication of certain responsibilities in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But that's straight out of that. Just that part of it is like cold, like the Grand Tour is. It's the cold, hard facts of life just said in those lines. There's no hiding from anything in those lines because it's exactly true. I think of all the women I pretend mean more than you. That's... I could hear George Jones singing that. He just wouldn't sing the other stuff about Little John. He definitely wouldn't have sung that.
So you come from a long sort of lineage of musicians.
Four generations of musicians of my family, of which I'm the third.
And then what about your son?
Yeah, there's musicians in this generation as well. Yeah.
Yeah, great. Time to hear it. This is American Without Tears by Elvis Costello.
Seem to talk. Oh, it seems we've been crying for years and for years. Now I don't speak any English, just American without tears, just American without tears. Oh, it seems we've been crying for years and for years.
I want to thank you for Punch the Clock, and I also want to thank you for introducing Mr. Chet Baker.
Oh, that was a good... That's a good introduction to make, isn't it? You know, I mean, yeah. I'd sort of... My parents kind of were jazz fans. My dad was originally a jazz trumpet player.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I had, like, more... I knew as much about that music as a kid, just from their talking about those artists, than I did about rock and roll, really, because...
Yeah.
Rock and roll was a bit square in the very early 60s when I was, you know, it was Elvis's records after he came out of the army weren't terrific. I wasn't old enough to remember the real shock of rock and roll in the 50s.
Yeah.
Because if it had been playing on the radio, which I don't think it was very much, my parents weren't tuned into it. They were listening to other things by choice, you know.
Yeah.
And what you know is what, you know, like if you grow up in the church, that's what you know. If you grow up in a classical music family, that's what you know. And I was the same. So,
yeah.
And then my dad was in a dance band which had to do all the hits of the day. So I got all sorts of records came through the door with him then, you know. I'm grateful to him for the cast off 45s that he gave me because I had far more than I ever could have afforded to buy, you know.
Oh, I got the eyes and have blues. I'm telling you people the natural facts. I'm gonna tell you people my belief. Cause I am headed straight on relief. Oh, I've got the Eisenhower Blues.
Tell me about Eisenhower Blues.
Recorded for no other reason than we wanted to play more music.
I mean, it sounds like it was done live in a bar to me. I mean, that's, and I think that, and I mean that in a good way, you know?
It was, there's good and good. Cool is a rule, but sometimes bad is bad, you know? Really, the way round it is, I don't know, does Poison Rose follow this on the record?
Yeah, it follows it, yeah.
Yeah, well, obviously that was recorded first. and Poison Rose was the objective of the session. I think I was incredibly, more than any other session on the record, I was more nervous singing with this rhythm section than any other of the combinations, because I really, I knew I had the songs that I figured if James could play as beautifully as he does on Our Little Angel and End of Fireworks. And we have, like, I don't know whether anything, whether it was signifying anything, but it's occurred to me later that the decision to have a French melodeon on American Without Tears, a song about transplants, you know, about people who have not come from a totally different culture.
Yeah.
We've got occasion accordions. It comes from a completely different part of the world. You know, it's in itself. Joel Sonia, you know, who passed this year, sadly, he was a wonderful musician. He played that part, and he was such a spirit. He came in and played that and was, you know, he lit it up. And I just wish we'd had some faster music for him to play. You know, he did.
Right.
You probably know that he recorded Richard Thompson's Tear-Stained Letter, and it was the very last song he played.
Wow, yeah.
He played it on stage, came off stage, and died. And this earlier this year in Plano, Texas. And I thought, very sad to read of his passing. On the other hand, he was playing right to the very end. You know, he was literally playing.
It's
some people
thing,
like to
yeah.
go out doing the thing they want to do.
Yeah,
I know that's no consolation for his family, but I mean, I have the... You're comforted by the idea that he was doing what he was built to do, which was play. And so with this, you know, you've got, of all of the musicians, you've got, like, if you started to think about the records that these guys have played on, you wouldn't be able to open your mouth.
Yeah.
Because you've got Earl Palmer on the drums. He played on Tutti Frutti. If he'd just done that, that would be it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's completely... invents a way to play on that record that, you know, is everything. And so many other records that he played on. I mean, you know, the Flintstones theme, for heaven's sake. He's the drummer on that, I think. You know, Mission Impossible.
I'm impressed.
Because they were, you know, he was one of, along with Hal Blaine, he was one of the, what they later called the Wrecking Crew, the LA session guys. Ray Brown also. But Ray Brown had this gigantic history in jazz. He, in himself, is like the founder of a particular approach to the bass in jazz. You can hear his personality on hundreds of records. Hundreds. You know, just his... Whether it's with on playing with Charlie Parker or playing with, you know, for years with Oscar Peterson. It was terrifying to play with him. And he was the nicest, most encouraging fellow.
Yeah.
You know, like, definitely... had a presence, but he tried to put me at ease. We got it. I've said this many times, but it's also incredibly true. He said, just before we went into the take, he said, nobody play any ideas into his bass mic. He leant down and said that into the bass mic. And in a way, it sounds like something, it's like something you say to a child who's frightened, you know. Don't worry, it'll be all right. It was like, because if you do think, sometimes that thinking gets in the way of feeling, right? And last song you wanted a lot of thinking going on, and it's Poison Rose. I mean, the song is crafted well enough. You just have to sing what's there. You don't have to have a lot of ideas about what you're singing. You just have to sing what's actually you've already written.
It's incredible.
And
song.
Thankfully, I did. You know, I did, and it's a good take. And Ray plays the... you know, the accompaniment on it, just the bass and the first verse. So that made it even more of a high wire act. You know, I didn't want my voice to crack while he's playing great. And then after that, I was like, send out for the whiskey, you know, because let's have some fun, you know. And that's how we end up playing this J.B. Lenoir song for about 2 hours. And we're just in there kind of jamming on that song. I mean, I wish we'd really just thought of other songs to play, or I had written 3 or 4 other ones, because I think we could have... It could have been like one of those sessions where we'd cut another record if I'd had the songs that suited their style. I just didn't have more songs like Poison Rose. There's more songs like, you know, there's several songs on the record that kind of have a country kind of rhythm to them, but not many that have that kind of it's some sort of, I don't know, I said I was thinking like Nightlife by Willie Nelson, you know, like that's what I was trying to go for when I wrote it, you know.
With the Eisenhower Blues, I was thinking of, like, you know, the Dylan warm-ups with Johnny Cash or George Harrison, you know, they've only just come out, really.
They're not, it's not the quality of the music, it's the spirit of us playing, that's why it fades out.
Yeah.
And it's where it fades out and then comes back in, because I think we got the cut right, so it stays in time.
Yeah.
But there's about 10 minutes more of playing in between that. We were just playing forever, you know. We played a whole reel of tape, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, just
there was no need
running
to put a, you know, however long is a reel of tape, 10 minutes or something?
It was 15, I think, wasn't it?
15. So it was probably a 15-minute take of that, you know.
Yeah.
We were just playing.
Love it.
Just for the sake of it, you know.
Well, the Poison Rose on a Valentine's card that you took straight to the heart that you call My Junkyard.
Yeah, that's an allusion to a couple of different songs, but that's of no consequence. But I like that song. We've been singing that one recently. I enjoy singing that one to this day.
That's so good.
Yeah, thank you. And I mean, the odd thing in our house is that Ray went on to be one of my wife's mentors.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he gave her lessons when she was 20, and then he played on one of her first recordings. She got to work with one of her heroes, and so the last time I saw Ray, I'd go see him play when he played in London. I'd go see him in Ronnie's. Remember one night I was sitting in Ronnie Scott's watching him play with a trio, and he did a shout out to me from the bandstand, which really took me by surprise. I didn't know he knew I was in the house. Somebody must have told him. And all the jazz, you know, sort of purists are in there going, how does Ray Brown know Elvis Costello? You know, they had no idea about my record. You know, they didn't know there was any connection. The last time I saw him on his way to a gig in Portland, Oregon. And there he was, like, and I said, we've got somebody in common. And he said, who? I said, Diana. And he went, Crowell. I mean, he always called her by her second name. So, like, it was a lovely memory of him, you know, like, and then he was just gone. He was gone with his bass, going to do what he did. 6 weeks later, he was gone. And that was, you know, he was playing, like another one, playing the whole life. You know, you kind of wish, well, I wish we still had those people of that authority and beauty of still playing. But that wasn't to be.
Let's hear another track from the album, the third on side two. This is Poison Rose by Elvis Costello.
Into this very sad affair. Somebody spikes the drink, and a single becomes a pair. The poison rose that you wear.
I got the big light, and you know, I just thought I'd throw it out there, but it has like Tombstone Blues kind of feel to it. Love the rim shot, the kind of, like, you know, really in your face.
Yeah.
Beautiful production. Guitar solo.
Yeah, the guitar solo is just killer, you know. It's like, but that's like another one of those ones that's like of the life, you know, because it was certainly, that was, it's a bit having a bit of a sense of humor about the hangover, you know.
I didn't open up another bottle of inspiration.
Yeah, well, you know, a little bit. I developed a little bit of self-awareness by then, you know, tiny, tiny little glimmer. Somehow I managed to write all these songs. I don't know how, really. I mean, I wasn't terribly, you know, disciplined in other parts of the day, but obviously enough to write these. And I wouldn't say I only wrote like this because I was drinking. Definitely I wrote about drinking, and there's seven references to it in these songs, but it didn't dominate the way I thought about or myself or anything else. Most people couldn't tell when I was drunk.
Right.
That was one of those people. That's why I had to stop, because I think it was like I was probably doing more damage because I'd just resist. Some people were happy drunks. I was like I wasn't sullen. I was just like silent. You know, but like the only time I didn't talk was when I was loaded, you know. So maybe this is something, I think there is something that I will say is true, and really incredible thing. I don't know whether you've seen the documentary. I think it's 2 or 3 part with Wayne Shorter. He talks about drinking brandy early on, and it created a space around him in which other people couldn't enter. And he wasn't by any means recommending it or saying that's the way to do it, kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I did recognize that zone.
Yeah,
in my
yeah,
own
yeah,
experience, yeah. So there was a time yeah. when gin was my drink, and there was
yeah,
a
gin gets
people,
mentioned in
people
the album, doesn't
couldn't
it?
Enter that space very easily. It couldn't interfere with my imagination in that space. It was my weapon of choice, you know. And I'm not saying that to, you know, romanticize it so much as just acknowledge that it's part of the method to get in a place where you dream this dream. Coleridge, he smoked opium, didn't he, or something, you know, to write those poems. So I guess I didn't do too bad.
I did a whole album on absinthe once.
Well, that'll do it. That'll do it. I just had a glass of it once, and I've never been the same. No, that's part of it. And it's something you have to learn the beginning and end of.
Yeah,
in my
yeah.
experience, that's the beginning and the end of. Otherwise, it becomes the same song over and over.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't drink anymore either. Yeah. I think it's kind of better.
But I don't judge, and I'm always interested in songs that come from that process. And
yeah,
there's
me
many
too.
Great ones, you know.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite songs is No Reason to Quit.
Oh.
By Merle Haggard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw Merle at the El Rey Theatre.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good place to have
yeah,
seen
it. It's, yeah, it's kind of an expensive ticket in a kind of obviously a smaller place, but
yeah.
it's a nice sort of. In the noughties.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw him opening for Bob Dylan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was very funny.
Wait, was that
yeah.
I saw him at Pantages.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. I saw that
yeah.
too.
Yeah. He said he'd never spoken to him on the whole tour. It seemed very weird because I would think, surely Bob loves Merle, you know.
Yeah.
I imagined that they would be hanging out, but I guess that just wasn't the way it was.
Graham liked Merle as well, right? Graham Parsons liked Merle.
Yeah. I think I came to understand, you know, something about these forms of music from, obviously, first through the Birds and Burritos.
Yeah.
And then the first two Graham records. He did exactly what, with the benefit of hindsight, I probably should have done when I went to Nashville for the first time, which is record with musicians that play that kind of music.
Wow.
Which we were so much in a band, we went as a band to Nashville and recorded Almost Blue, but the producer didn't understand because he didn't understand the way we played at all, and we were sufficiently dug in with that idea of being a band at that time that there was tension about it, and only a couple of the songs worked. But by the time I got to this record, I'd learned that lesson. And it is the example of Graham, is that I love the way the Burritos play, but it's really different. You know, even Sweetheart of the Rodeo,
yeah.
the reason it sounded so great
yeah.
is because it had Pete Drake on it. And it had Pete Drake, who played on my first session in Nashville, and Clarence,
yeah.
who was a straight-up bluegrass player
yeah.
who picked up the Telecaster, was just masterful, kind of. And that's, you know, that's that, I think... When Graham departed and then did the Burritos and then did those records for Warner Brothers, the very first thing he did was exactly what I did. He hired Elvis Presley's band.
Yeah.
You know, he did. He had Glenn D and Ronnie Tutt yeah. and, you know, Emery Gordy, I think, on bass. But I mean,
was Bob Moore involved at that point?
I don't know.
Nah.
But I mean, you know, he wanted that. He obviously must have wanted that. He could have had
oh,
anybody.
Yeah.
And I mean, and Emmylou also from that then had James. And I saw James like 2 weeks ago. I helped induct him into the Country Music
oh,
Hall of Fame.
Wow. What
and
an
it's
honor.
A wonderful thing. I've never been to it before. And they keep you locked in a dressing room because they want to surprise the artist
fantastic.
With who's come to pay them tribute, you know. And it was
like, this is your line.
So he didn't know I was coming out, and I sang this early Ricky Nelson song. I can't say one I would have chosen for myself, but I was happy to sing it. John Georgeson, who played in the Desert Rose Band with Chris Hillman, was playing the guitar, and then they had Rodney Crowell and Emmy and Vince Gill did Till I Gain Control, and then the real surprise was Keith Richard.
Yeah.
Keith Richard and Steve Jordan did I Can't Dance, which was absolutely a knockout. Emmy's on her way to the stage and she said, I've not sung this song for 50 years since I cut it for Grievous Angel. She'd never, it's never been in her repertoire. She'd never sung the song since the session.
Wow.
For it, or maybe when they did it, if they did it live. I've never even heard a live recording of that song, you know. So it was pretty great.
That's amazing.
It was pretty great. And there, James was seemed to genuinely touched by it all. So that's was he deserves it, of course, to think of the number of records that he's on. I mean, Working Man Blues, Alone, speaking of Merle. That's James.
Wow. Here it is, The Big Light by Elvis Costello on Absolute Radio. Also, in between just going to, cracking on with the album, I wanted to also thank you, seeing as this is like, you know...
It's like a Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is a couple of weeks from now, Tim.
I know, but I thought we'd just get in there early, you know.
No, it's very nice of you, thank you. You're saying very kind things.
Thank you for producing two of my favourite albums, Bookending My Teenage Years, which specials.
Yeah. That's a great record.
And Rum, Sodomy and The Latch.
Yeah.
And I thought, both those bands have so many members. Yeah. Were you the guy kind of like, you know, heard in the kind of, you know, cattle?
It was certainly Specials was, you know, there were different personalities and a very, very strong musical head on Jerry Damas and a vision, you know. And then the other people were part of something. I think some of the time there was the reality that the band had and the plan that Jerry had, and those two things were not always exactly the same.
Yeah.
I think he would probably accept that, and probably that's why after a while it wasn't possible to make it work as people got more assertive.
Yeah.
I had absolutely no idea. I just thought Terry was terrific at singing these songs.
Terry's great.
I had no idea all the other things that were in his head, including the difficult things, you know, which he talked about. And although we were published by the same publisher, we never really got to know one another after the Specials, which is a regret now.
Right.
I'm still very good friends with Lindvall.
Yes.
And he's really
lovely,
the only one that I'm still in touch with. He's a lovely man.
Yeah, he is.
And, you know, we sat and we talked about the stuff we never had time to talk about. I had no idea, for one thing, he was older than me, so his experience of coming to England, you know, from Jamaica was kind of quite... It was like something that you would, you know, you would write a book about, you know, because he said, my dad decided that I should come and live with him, and he left his family, and I was like, wow, you were pretty young to do that, you know. It was like, go to secondary school and it'd be completely different. It's a lot of people's experience, you know, so... So I remember sitting with him in Texas about 6-7 years ago, maybe longer. But I love that record, and I'm very proud of that one. I mean, I didn't know anything technically. I've said many times, both those records were really... I took the producer's chair to stop somebody else, you know...
Coming in and ruining
it. Maybe adding a veneer, you know, like all in good faith.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, you know, and also bands... You know, once they've had some degree of success, then what is going to ensure that success and what is going to get them to an even bigger audience? And, you know, there's a lot of good music on the record that the Pogues made after the album that I did, but not as much of it written by Shane McGowan.
Right, got you.
You know what I mean? Because it was having to incorporate, and maybe he wasn't actually writing as many.
Yeah.
Songs, so you know, it was more of a balance between the things, and probably I wouldn't have been the man to produce that.
Yeah,
so Steve Lillywhite did that, and he really knew how to make a shinier, bigger version while still keeping the guts in it.
Yeah,
but I hadn't listened to that album in 20 years, and after Shane passed, he and I were not friends, you know, we were never friends during the making of it. I didn't stay in touch with him afterwards.
Yeah.
I very much admired him. He didn't think much of me, and it made that very obvious.
Wow.
So I was just convenience, really, that I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And did the best job I could. And some of it involved, you know, timing the discipline of the performances against people's intake. You know, this is not stuff that I was a stranger to myself. You know, so, right. I remember being on. I had a TV show for a while, and somebody came on with a glass of whiskey in their hand. And I went, no, that's not going to work with me. You know, I've seen this movie before. You know, I've been this movie before. You know, so don't come it. You know, like all that kind of dissolute artist stuff. I always thought it was a bit of a get out clause for myself. Didn't you know? Had my years of doing that, and I mistrust that alibi. But it's everybody lives a different life, and you live the life you've got.
Yeah,
you know, you live the life you live. As Willie Dixon said, I love the life I live. He didn't even say, I live the life I live. He said, I love the life I live. He went further.
Wow.
Yeah. One of the first songs I ever heard other than the Beatles of my own volition was Georgie Fame's version of that song, which I realized much later was a copy of, that was Alison's rendition of that song.
Oh, wow.
But it was quite a big thing for, I don't know how old I was, 12-year-old. To fall in love with the song that says, you know, you see me passing when I walk, you see me walking when I pass you by, don't talk about me because I may be high. And you know, I kind of knew what it meant.
Yeah.
But I you know, and those songs were like a little glimpse into a world.
Yeah.
You know, well, I think it's what you're saying, you know, when you're an age and you don't know, is there anything, anybody going to, you know, tell me, what is it? What's the opening lines of Girl? You know, well, I was saying, said to somebody the other day, you know, was she told when she was young that pain would lead to pleasure?
Well,
it's kind of tremendously complex line
yep.
if you've just been done singing, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah.
It's kind of a glimpse into a different kind of, you know.
Do you think that was Dylan's influence, maybe, at that point, or just...
Maybe the license to say it.
Yeah.
I don't think it was the license to think it.
No, of course.
I think the license to say it, I think, was perhaps, by then, there's a lot of examples of that in Blonde on Blonde, particularly.
Yeah.
Which is around that time. I don't know which predates which, but, you know... There's a lot of things in Sooner or Later One of Us Must Know that are really heartbreaking when you read them on the page.
Yeah.
Because often when they're inflected by the singer in a way that absolves them from the responsibility because they're said as a put-down line or they're said as a smart aleck line.
Yeah.
When you actually read what the lyric of that song in particular is about, it's like, oh, my God, that's really horrible, you know, but truthful. You know?
I loved you there and then, it's as simple as that. It's everybody's boy, but sure that thrill just fails to be the lover, one true heart, or the jack of all the race. Or to be the lover, one true heart, or the jack.
Jack of all parades, and then Suit of Lights.
These are denser.
Mm-hmm.
These are different type of lyric writing on these.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a very much denser lyric, Jack of all parades.
Yeah.
There's a demo version of that which we came across where it segues into lyrics that are actually in Crimes of Paris. So I think these two songs were kind of... They were disentangling themselves, and sometimes verses would link up.
Yeah.
Maybe they're thematically connected.
Yeah.
Suit of Lights is a much more brutal song. I mean, it's a. I wrote that one about seeing my father play towards the end of his career, and it was very hard to see him struggling to. People just seemed very impatient, and I think it was a shift towards. people singing along with track and basically like a karaoke type of approach to the kind of clubs that he played in. And I knew my dad was still singing really well. He was playing well. He was very practiced in what he did. He was an entertainer. He didn't get to record songs of his own. He didn't write very much. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the same sort of thing that I could say, well, I'm for better or for worse, these are the songs I've got.
Yeah,
you don't get to choose. I get to choose. That's what you're paying me for. That's the way I think about it, you know. Buying a record 40 years ago doesn't mean that you get to pick the set list. I pick the set list. And trust me, it'll be better that way. If you actually listen with your ears and not with your nostalgic head on, it'll be more truthful. And we'll get to the good old good ones that you think you want to hear by a route that makes them feel real to me. And that's the only way I can sing them well.
Yeah.
And that's true of Indoor Fireworks now, because that's long enough ago. If I put it somewhere where it's not well chosen, where it sits in the set, I won't be able to find my way into it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of complicated associations and memories in these songs, but I never sing songs for nostalgic reasons.
Yeah.
Even songs that I know specifically refer to events in the past, that's my knowledge of what the song is. The audience is paying for you to sing it as honestly as you can,
yeah,
the way they feel about it in the moment of hearing it, not necessarily the way they felt about it when they first heard it, which is a different thing, because that's the record.
Yeah, exactly.
If you want that experience, you have to just listen to the record.
Yeah.
If you want it always to be the same every time, that's why we make records. Songs, on the other hand, are a plastic form that are open to reinterpretation, you know, nuance, frailty, time, circumstances, you know, the mood you're in that day, the mood the audience is in that day.
Yeah.
And all of those things affect the way shows are constructed. So when I went from this record, I knew that if you looked at what these songs were about, it would have been the same thing as if I'd put all the really sad songs, if I'd put Suffering Face and King of Confidence onto the album in place of Glitter Gulch and Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which, believe me, I did consider, had to be talked out of. The record would have maybe gone down, even more down in flames than it did anyway upon its initial release. So I'm glad if people have heard it now and they can hear it, and they can hear where it leads as well. Now they can hear where it leads. In the immediate year after, where it led to is the concert at the Albert Hall.
Right.
Which is the best recording we have of that band playing with Keltner, Chef, rhythm section, James Burton on guitar, Ben Montench from the Heartbreakers on keyboard, T-Bone Walker's kind of auxiliary.
Is this all on the box set then?
This is all in the box.
Wonderful.
And I would say it has a pretty good claim for being the most off-the-hook James Burton live record ever released. Like, because I just let him go. He just played wilder on this recording than he ever did even with Elvis, even on the live recordings, you know. Because the solos are pretty short on the Elvis performances.
Yeah,
he'd just do a little burst, and then he'd be back in the back.
Yeah.
And he would always be there, but he wouldn't, like, it's not like he's stretching out and doing 10 minutes or anything, but that you take a listen to it, you'll be kind of surprised. I think it's a wonderful thing. I played one of the tracks for James 2 weeks ago, and I said, man, this is you tearing it up at the Royal Albert Hall.
Yeah.
This is you playing the Telecaster this.
Yeah.
It's just great. It's great. So what I did when we went to do the shows, because the audience that was coming to that knew from, particularly in England, they'd already been freaked out by me going to Nashville and making a record. That split the audience in half. That there was like the original people who liked Armed Forces and things like that didn't like Almost Blue.
Right.
And then it was a Radio 2 hit when Radio 2 was the more sedate sister of Radio 1, which we still aspired to be on. Suddenly we had a Radio 2 hit.
Yeah, well.
And I had, like, what to me then were older women chatting me up in the fish fingers department of Marks and Spencer's. And I'm going, what is going on here? I'm going to turn into David Soul if I'm not careful. You know, it's like, it was really weird. It was really weird. I realized I'd made a romantic song.
Wow.
And people just liked it, you know.
I love that.
And I thought, well, I can't make a career out of that. I don't have the matinee looks for it, you know. Like, I'm not going to suddenly... Christ, I saw Tom Jones once at I was on a charity gig with him once, and the people started to throw knickers at him, and he was like, you could tell he was like, let me sing. Let me sing. He's one of the greatest singers who ever walked the earth. Why are you throwing your underwear at him? Believe me, some of that underwear needed to be kept out of sight as well. You know, it was like...
Amazing.
It was like, but anyway, that didn't happen, you know. And what we end up with knowing that this would be a hard sell,
yeah,
particularly to the London audience. And if you listen to the live record, you can hear the applause at the top is more curious than enthusiastic.
Oh yeah.
And as the show goes on, it gets like more vociferous.
Wow.
As they realize what's actually going
wow,
on.
Wow, wow, wow.
Because it's not a slow, melancholy show at all, because we're doing, you know, It Tears Me Up and The Only Daddy That'll Walk the Line and these swinging things like Sally Sue Brown and What Would I Do, Ray Charles song, and Your Mind Is on Vacation, Your Funeral, you know, and Your Funeral and My Trial, and Pouring Water on a Drowning Man. I did a bunch of songs by people I loved. There's Riverboat by Alan Toussaint.
Yeah.
This is in 86. This is after I'd first met him.
Yeah.
But before we'd worked together on my own songs, or long before we did the album together. So you understand that including Riverboat on this live album, that is where I think, if you want to follow the story that I'm telling, the reason this is called In the Box is called King of America and Other Realms. Those other realms are the cities of New Orleans, the cities of Memphis, Nashville, Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, they're all places that I visited on location.
Yeah.
Clarksdale, Mississippi, Oxford, Mississippi, you know. And these are places where, as an outsider, not as somebody who was born to it, I think you know this because you've lived in America, you know, you get deeply in to these clues that once came, and they were very, very hard to decode initially, because the evidence for where these one thing came from or led to,
yeah,
was not readily available. Certainly not for me growing up.
Yeah,
I'm a few years older than you, so it was even harder.
Yeah,
because the way radio was set up, you could hear one song by that artist, but you might never hear another one.
Yeah.
So you go, where did that music go? Where did it come from? And where did it lead? You know, it took me, sometimes it would be 20 years later when I first eventually went to America and I had a little bit of cash in my hand. I go in a secondhand record shop, I go, oh my God, there's a whole album by that person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
I just thought it was that one song on a compilation.
Yeah,
and there's a whole album. And look, and you get it home and you go, and all of the tracks are great, you know. Because you had no way to, you know, there'd always be somebody who'd put something in your way. And of course, one of the advantages of the way we absorb music now is that everything is instantaneously.
Yeah, yeah.
But you still got to know where to look.
Yeah, it's true.
Otherwise, it's like a lot of hay and a few needles. And the golden needles are hard to find.
Next up is the penultimate song on King of America, Suit of Light. Penultimate song on King of America, Suit of Lights. Tim Burgess here, coming to the end of another listening party, this time with Elvis Costello. I wanted to know, you know, how long had you had the songs before you kind of really, you know, dug in and sort of like got immersed in it and sort of like, you know.
I did a little bit of digging into books and things, and I found like set lists that revealed that when I went out on that first solo tour in 84,
Yeah.
I was initially mostly doing the songs from Goodbye Cruel World, but I was doing them in a very bare and, you know, unavoidable. There's a song on that record which I think could almost be on King of America called The Home Truth.
Yeah.
You know, which is, I hung up the phone tonight just as you said, I love you. Once this would have been coincidence, now these things seem to bother me. And it's mm-hmm. about, you know, people recognizing they're going to break up, and that those portents of the heartbreaker that are in there. That could have easily been on this record. It could have been the song before Indoor Fireworks instead of Glitter Gulch, but then the record would have been even yeah. more melancholy, wouldn't it? You know, so, and Columbia would have liked it even less, you know.
They would have liked it even less, but it would have, you know, I mean, it would have fit, yeah, of yeah. course.
And there's other songs, you know, the second CD, the one I mentioned before, in the box yeah. at least, that yeah. contains the, what I call the Le Roi sans sabot, the king without clogs. It's just a joke. I don't know why I made the joke in French. It just sounded funnier that way. I wanted to give it like this grand noble title. I gave them all like these titles in bad French and bad Italian and bad Spanish. I wanted all these other programs to have their own identity. And one of the things that turns up in this is the song "Suffering Face," which is a very intense demo that I think really is a master. I don't think it's a demo at all. I think it's the right, performance yeah. of that song. And yeah. it could have easily been on the album, but again, would have made it even slower, even sadder. And, you know, people can, of course, if they want to live in that world, they could collect these songs together that enter yeah. that world. And I think one of the things that I've taken advantage of on this opportunity to make an anthology that bridges the 40-year parts of my career is yeah. to sequence songs together that I disguise their intention by putting them putting a happy song between them. I've learned my lesson from King of America that if you look at the tracks from National Ransom, you'll find the darkest songs about the ways of the world all grouped together.
Yeah.
So there's no way to lighten it, because lightening it isn't what it's about. You write them because they matter to you, and that's sometimes it. Your instincts are, you second guess yourself, oh, I'd better let some light into the room, otherwise people will get oppressed by what these songs are about. But in the end, I think it sometimes means they just overlook them entirely, because they don't land the way you really. And if you get in a room and play Bullets from the Newborn King from National Ransom, people will react.
Yeah.
People will go, oh my yeah. God, what's that? And most people yeah. have never heard it before, because that record's really obscure. It's an obscure song from an album that sold 5 copies. But it also contains maybe pound for pound more good songs than what any other record I've released, you know? And that's like saying, I'm not talking down my early records, but there's a lot of rubbish on those. You know, we all made records so quickly. There's a lot of made-up stuff on those early records that people romanticize. I go, you think that's a good song? Are you on drugs? I mean, it's like that's just something I made up in 2 minutes. It just sounds good because of the way we're singing it, you know, because we're singing it with, like, it took, I was enormously surprised. I mentioned that Spanish Model record. I was enormously surprised to find that some of the songs on that record had melodies.
Right.
Because I didn't know they had melodies until I heard somebody with a more melodious voice singing them back to me in another language. If you listen to a song like Hand in Hand from this year's Model, I kind of go, it's all about attitude. It's all about attitude. You know this.
Yeah.
The front yeah. of a rock mm-hmm. and roll singer. I had no idea yeah. what the tune was. It never occurred to me there was a melody. You know. So, you know, obviously as you get a little older, you become more, you have more things at your disposal to tell the story, then you can do these, you can make these juxtapositions work in your favor. That's the hope, anyway.
Well, Elvis, this has just been brilliant, and I want to thank you so much.
I feel like a madman half the time trying to explain half of this stuff, because it doesn't seem real to me.
Well, It is.
You know what I'm saying? Honest to God, doesn't seem real
and,
to me.
You know, I think you can tell I'm a huge fan, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
I really appreciate it, man. You really did your homework.
I want to go and listen to the Royal Albert Hall now.
Oh, you'll have fun.
Yeah, I will.
Good luck to you. Okay, bye-bye.
This is the last song on King of America, Sleep of the Just.
I suppose that you need the sleep of the just. The girl woke up in a naked light and said, oh no, not again. He even looked like a brother in the army, but she never mentions him. You'll be tucked up in his bed tonight with his dirty bitch's girl. Saying you're some mother's daughter, you know. Or is it?
I sleep with the Just files, Stella, heard in this listening party on Absolute Radio. Thank you to Elvis for taking me through his 1986 album King of America. Don't forget you can hear a special reissued version of the album King of America and Other Realms right now. If you've heard the show before, you know I like to end each episode by telling you about what I've been listening to recently. I've been listening to Gram Parsons, it's called GP. You know, Gram Parsons is a favourite of mine, formerly of Flying Burrito Brothers and The Byrds, but GP is an amazing solo album and I highly recommend it. And as this is an Elvis Costello listening party, and you know, he's written so many amazing tracks, let's have Mighty Like a Rose is the album, but the song is called The Other Side of Summer. Play Kate Bush all the time. And I want to play Wild Man by Kate Bush from the album 50 Words for Snow. I know I like to mention New Order on most of these podcasts, and I have been listening to Technique by New Order quite a lot this last week. And so the track Loveless by New Order from Technique. And while we're talking about recommendations, why don't you recommend this show to a friend? Tell them to play any previous listening party by just searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. Every song in this episode of my listening party was taken from Elvis Costello's King of America. All tracks are written by Elvis Costello unless noted. The album was released on F-Beat and Columbia in February 1986. See you next time.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.